Welcome to Guns and Butter, The Economics of Politics. I'm Kelly O'Ramaris with Bonnie Faulkner. Guns and Butter investigates the relationships among capitalism, militarism, and politics. Maintaining a progressive perspective in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks, Guns and Butter, The Economics of Politics, reports on who wins and who loses when the economic resources of civil society are diverted toward global corporatization, war, and the furtherance of a national security state.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today we're featuring Michael C. Rupert, publisher and editor of From the Wilderness Publications, on The Truth and Lies of 9/11. The following is from a presentation Rupert gave on February 21st in San Francisco.
This is the seventh lecture that I have given in the 9/11 series. I want to leave you tonight with the message that your lives and your liberty are on the line now. There is no more opportunity for armchair discussion. There is no more time. The philosophy with which I started publishing From the Wilderness 4 years ago was very simple. I don't publish anything that I can't document. I don't ask you to take anything that I write on faith. I will offer opinions, and I'll tell you their opinions. I'll give you my analysis. But I don't make any assertions unless I tell you where I got the information so that you can go find it for yourself. And I have taken on some very big names in 4 years. I won't go through the litany. I have never been sued because truth is an absolute defense against libel. Absolutely. All the time. What I'm doing tonight is I'm presenting to you exactly the same way that I would present if I were a detective talking to a district attorney, or if I were an attorney talking to a grand jury. I'm presenting a case with the evidence. I will not speculate. There's a lot of things we're not going to talk about tonight which can't be proven. Were there explosives in the building? Were the airplanes flown by remote control? All these cul-de-sacs that you can't go into, that I can't produce proof for, I don't care. They're irrelevant. My job is to reach the people out there who haven't been reached with those facts that shake the foundation of their belief that they're the fundamentally most blessed people on the planet, enjoying a standard of living because God loves Americans above all other peoples in the world, which is what George Bush sells. I have to shake their belief in the system, and you don't do that with speculation. Now, there's some things that I have to tell you before we start talking about September the 11th. If you don't understand these things, you will never understand completely why September the 11th happened. One is drugs, and the other is oil. If you're in the U.S. government, in the executive branch, and somebody working under you commits a crime, there is a law in Title 18 U.S. Code that says you have to turn in your employees if they're committing crimes. You have to call the Justice Department, you have to call the FBI, and report the criminal activity. Well, they knew that. It's a law. So they had a negotiation. In this negotiation, which was between William French Smith, which you can barely read down here, that's Reagan's first attorney general, but you can read, boy, there's an oxymoron, the Honorable William J. Casey, Director of Central Intelligence, in view of the fine cooperation the Drug Enforcement Administration has received from CIA, no formal requirement regarding the reporting of narcotics violations has been included in these procedures. Let me let that sink in for a minute. The Attorney General has just notified the head of the CIA that he no longer has to tell the Department of Justice when his people are dealing drugs. There it is in black and white. Proof of a conspiracy, right there. By the way, do you know who negotiated this memorandum for William French Smith? Ken Starr. Now, there's one reason and one reason only why the CIA deals drugs. Not to fund covert operations, not to make George Bush rich, but to support the U.S. economy. June 27th, 1999, New York Stock Exchange chief meets Colombian top rebel commander, Bogota. A guy by the name of Dick Grasso flies to Bogota and meets with the FARC guerrillas. Now, everybody knows in Colombia, right, everybody deals drugs, right? Everybody, left, right, center, government, paramilitaries, they all deal drugs. And what Dick Grasso said when he was meeting with the FARC commander was, will you please invest your drug money in Wall Street? That's what he said. It's in the story right there. He didn't say drug money, but he said, let us manage your funds. And it's, you know, everybody knows the only way that FARC makes money is by taxing the cocaine trade. Black and white. Didn't hear that on Peter Jennings, did you? Okay, so he's asking for money to Wall Street. And you know what the FARC guys told him? They said, no, senor. A year later, President Bill Clinton announces Plan Colombia. You know, and we since displaced 2 million people from their homes by spraying glyphosate from Monsanto. And we're spraying food crops, of course, and we're just driving the cocaine production onto lands controlled by the paramilitaries. And we're getting ready to go to war in Colombia again because there's oil there. But let's stay on the drug theme for a minute. In January of last year, Senator Carl Levin of Michigan, author of a minority report from the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations on Correspondent Banking, and this is a copy of, this is the first page of the report. I just wanted to show you what the report looks like. You go down at the bottom, it says, inattention by and disinterest by U.S. banks in screening the foreign banks they take in as clients have allowed rogue foreign banks and their criminal clients to carry on money laundering and other criminal activity in the United States. And yes, that's true, and to protect the narcotics industry. And then if you read the report a little bit further, it says J.P. Morgan, who was, by the way, the largest creditor of Enron, Bank of America, Citigroup, and First Union are laundering all this drug money. It says down here, $1 trillion laundered annually. That's from the U.S. Senate. And it says $500 billion through the United States banking system. The rest of it's going through Wall Street. The current regime, the current empire, and we are an empire now, get that straight, has crossed a line of criminality from which it cannot turn back. It has no alternative now but to proceed apace until it imposes a full dictatorship, a full fascist state, because the level of criminality is so out of the closet they just don't care anymore. But I saw this back in May when Citibank, Citigroup, by the way, who's on the board of directors at Citigroup? John Deutsch, the former CIA director, Robert Rubin, of Goldman Sachs, former Secretary of the Treasury, a woman named Nora Slatkin, the former CIA Executive Director, that's the number three position. They paid $12 billion to buy Banco Nacional de Mexico, Banamex, second largest bank in Mexico. It is an overt, open, drug money laundering bank in Mexico. So overt that a brilliant Mexican newspaper named Por Esto wrote a story about 2 years ago about the bank's owner, Roberto Hernandez. He owns most of the Yucatan Peninsula. In fact, the natives refer to it as the Cocaine Peninsula. There's landing strips all over the place. There's refueling for boats. And they published all this documenting that Hernandez was a major drug trafficker. By the way, in August of 2000, Bill Clinton vacationed for 10 days on Hernandez's property. President-elect Vicente Fox, the first day after winning the election, paid a courtesy call on Roberto Hernandez. Roberto Hernandez shared a media consultant with George W. Bush. Hernandez now sits on the board of directors with Robert Rubin, John Deutsch at Citigroup. They don't care if you know how criminal they are anymore. They are laughing at you, and they hold the rest of the American people in utter contempt. Let's take a little look at CIA and Wall Street. The National Security Act of 1947 was written by Clark Clifford, an aide to Harry Truman, longtime Democratic Party powerhouse. He wrote the act that created the CIA. Who can tell me what his profession was? Wall Street lawyer and banker. As a matter of fact, Clark Clifford is the American who brought the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, BCCI, onto American shores. Okay, BCCI was a huge drug money laundering bank. Now, the CIA was designed for Clifford by two brothers, John Foster and Alan Dulles. John Foster was Secretary of State under Dwight Eisenhower. Alan Dulles was DCI, get used to the term, Director of Central Intelligence, DCI. From 53 to 61, John Kennedy fired him after the Bay of Pigs. What was their profession? Wall Street lawyers from the firm Sullivan and Cromwell, the most powerful law firm, wouldn't we agree on that, on Wall Street. By the way, who are Enron's attorneys? Sullivan and Cromwell. Okay, Bill Casey. All right, most of us are old enough to remember Iran-Contra. What was Bill Casey's job for Richard Nixon? He was chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Stanley Sporkin, retired recently as a U.S. District Court judge in Washington, D.C., CIA General Counsel in the 1980s. What was his job before he was the CIA General Counsel? He was General Counsel of the SEC. David Daugherty, who was the CIA General Counsel after Stanley Sporkin. Anybody know what he does now? You're going to love this one. Executive Vice President of the New York Stock Exchange for Enforcement. And a guy by the name of A.B. Buzzy Krongard. A.B. Buzzy Krongard is currently the Executive Director, or ex-DIR, at CIA. The top three positions are DCI, Director of Central Intelligence, DDI, Deputy Director for Intelligence, and Executive Director, ex-DIR. The current Executive Director of the CIA. What was his job before he went to the CIA in 1998? CEO of Alex Brown, or A.B. Brown, a major investment bank. Remember that. By the way, does everybody agree that I've presented a case that there is a very deep, long-standing relationship between the CIA and Wall Street? As a matter of fact, six of the first seven DDIs of the CIA came directly from Wall Street to the agency. I thank my dear friend Peter Dale Scott over in Berkeley for pointing that out. Zbigniew Brzezinski, National Security Advisor to Jimmy Carter, trustee and founder of the Trilateral Commission, international advisor of several major global corporations, associate of Dr. Henry Kissinger. Under Ronald Reagan, member of the NSC Defense Department Commission on Integrated Long-Term Strategy. Under Ronald Reagan, member of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. This guy is everywhere on both parties, which is where you have to go to solve this. If there's anybody in this room who thinks that just by throwing the bushes out, this is all going to go away, go home and take some lithium, buy a straitjacket, and get yourself out of my way. If you want to get really mad, go out and buy this book. It's called The Grand Chessboard, American Primacy and Its Geostrategic Objectives by Zbigniew Brzezinski, written in 1997, 4 years before the first plane hit the World Trade Center. 4 years. We're going to look at some selected and very fun quotes from this book. He said, as we move into the end of the age of oil, as we move into a new world order, as we move into the 21st century, as the whole world changes, whoever controls Eurasia will be supreme. He talks about, in this book, maintaining U.S. primacy. He talks about China, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan. The largest untapped reserves of oil and natural gas in the world are right here. We couldn't build a pipeline out through Russia because the Russians knew that if they had the pipeline, they could control it and tax it. They could threaten American control, and they could move south to control all of this. And what's been on the table has been a long-planned pipeline to be headed by Unocal, built by Halliburton, the feasibility studies done by Enron, to be built from here straight down to the Pakistani coast. Now, the crying demand for oil now is in China, the Far East, which has an exploding economy needing energy. The plan is to build a pipeline and to transport it around to China and Japan, and, of course, to take whatever we need for U.S. use along the way. Now let's look at some quotes from what Brzezinski had to say in 1997. Bear in mind, every word of this was written 4 years before the World Trade Center. The public supported America's engagement in World War II largely because of the shock effect of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. For America, the chief geopolitical prize is Eurasia, and America's global primacy is directly dependent on how long and how effectively its preponderance on the Eurasian continent is sustained. America's withdrawal from the world, or because of the sudden emergence of a successful rival, would produce massive international instability. Maybe we would call that democracy. In that context, how America manages Eurasia Do we manage countries? Is that our job? Managers Eurasia is critical. Now, here's a quote that this has kind of become a tradition as I do this. We did it for a joke in Portland, but it's really caught on, and so I'm getting to like this. But I absolutely have to read with a German accent. Never before has a populist democracy attained international supremacy. The pursuit of power is not a goal that commands popular passion, except in conditions of a sudden threat or challenge to the public sense of domestic well-being. The economic self-denial that is the defense spending and the human sacrifice, I love that human sacrifice, casualties even among professional soldiers required in the effort are uncongenial to democratic instincts. Democracy is inimical to imperial mobilization. One lesson I learned a long time ago, what the gods would destroy, they would first make ludicrous. We must learn to laugh in their faces sometimes. I haven't done this yet. I should maybe do this one in a British accent. This just seems to fit better. To put it in a terminology that harkens back to the more brutal age of ancient empires, the three grand imperatives of imperial geostrategy are to prevent collusion and maintain security dependence among the vassals, to keep tributaries pliant, and to keep the barbarians from coming together. Referring to an area he calls the Eurasian Balkans and a 1997 map in which he has circled the exact location of the current conflict, describing it as the central region of pending conflict for world dominance, Brzezinski writes, "The Eurasian Balkans are a potential economic prize." Now, there is an old saying that I have learned from the intelligence community, God equals gold, oil, and drugs. In Afghanistan, we have all three. Where was the first place we sent military troops after September 11th? Uzbekistan. I got news for you. We were already there. Had been for some years. Training, preparing. Now listen to this very closely. An Islamic revival already abetted from the outside, not only by Iran, but also by Saudi Arabia, is likely to become the mobilizing impulse for the increasingly pervasive new nationalisms determined to oppose any reintegration under Russian, hence infidel, control. Now let me tell you a secret. The United States has created Islamic terrorists and Islamic fundamentalism. The reason we have created all of these groups was to keep Russia from getting anywhere near the oil in the Middle East and in Central Asia. A long-term plan. China's growing economic presence in the region and its political stake in the area's independence are also congruent with America's interests. China is totally behind this because they can't build a 5,000-mile pipeline. Halliburton can. Without sustained and directed involvement, before long, the forces of global disorder, democracy, could come to dominate the world scene. And the possibility of such a fragmentation is inherent in the geopolitical tensions, not only of today's Eurasia, but of the world more generally. Clearly, he saw Russia as the prime contender. And let me tell you how long this war was planned. During the decade of the 1990s, thanks to Al Gore, Victor Chernomyrdin, the Harvard Endowment, Goldman Sachs, the U.S. Treasury, the World Bank, and the IMF, under a very precisely orchestrated plan, Harvard and Goldman Sachs had the exclusive contract to teach the Russians how to become capitalists. And we looted, the United States looted $300 billion out of the Russian economy over that 10-year period. When the Soviet Union ceased to exist, the population of Russia, that was one of the republics, was about 164, 65 million people. When I was in Russia a year ago, the population was 145 million people. The life expectancy of the average male in Russia is 48 years. There were stories documented in Moldavia and areas outlying of Russia that people were selling flesh from human cadavers as fresh meat. Because there was no food. This is the Hubbert curve, or an extrapolation, widely recognized, widely accepted throughout the energy industry. Oil is a finite resource. Can we all agree on that? All oil production always follows a bell curve. When you drill your first well and you hit a gusher, so you get so much oil, then you drill more wells and you reach a peak of production over the life of an oil field. And then eventually the oil goes down further. You go into what's called secondary recovery, and you got to pump in water. And eventually it takes more energy to pump out a barrel of oil than you get from burning it. And that's when the field is essentially dead. There are new methods, you know, but there's no way to change that. World oil production will peak in the year 2006, never, ever, ever to be exceeded again. After that, world oil production will diminish. This is a line right here that shows that roughly around the year 2004-5, world hydrocarbon consumption per capita, the lines will cross, meaning that suddenly there's going to be conflict, there's going to be scarcity. But look at the line of population as it increases long after world oil production peaks in 2006. As demand is increasing, oil is becoming scarcer and scarcer. Remember that electricity, most of it comes from natural gas, which is the Siamese twin of oil. Plastics, fertilizer, jet fuel, car fuel, all comes from oil. This is inevitable. This is going to happen. And if you go a little bit further, we have another chart here that shows world oil production will peak in 2006, but the oil fields in the Middle Eastern countries, the members of OPEC, will peak last. In other words, it's inevitable that we're going to run out, but whoever runs out last wins the game. Following this model, this war that Dick Cheney says will not end in our lifetime starts to begin to make sense, doesn't it? Because the strategy will be, we have some reserves in ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Animal Refuge, but the United States will use its resources last by going around the world and controlling the rest of the world's oil resources, because the scientific research says that when you get to a point where there's 11 billion people, there's going to be maybe 5, 6, 7 billion too many people on the planet. And for the first time, although I've been seeing some evidence for years, I am beginning to suspect that these fools might have made a decision. Well, it's not the problem that there's too little oil. There's just too many people. Now, we're going to get to the heart of the presentation. I want you to put on your most skeptical hats. Here it comes. Here's the case. You're the jury. 1991 through 1997... major U.S. oil companies, including ExxonMobil, Texaco, Unocal, BP, Amoco, and Shell, directly invest $3 billion in cash, bribing the heads of state. That's illegal, by the way. There are two federal grand juries sitting now in Washington and New York City looking at violations of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. They bribe the heads of state in Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, to secure equity rights in the huge oil reserves in these regions. The oil companies further commit to future direct investment in Kazakhstan of $35 billion cash. That's for almost a decade. They couldn't get their money out. By the way, do you know who sat on the Kazakh government's oil advisory board during all of those years? Dick Cheney. Do you wonder why he's not disclosing the records of his energy task force? The source, by the way, was testimony for the House International Relations Committee and a wonderful article by Cy Hirsch in The New Yorker from last June. Seymour Hirsch. December 4th, 1997, representatives of the Taliban are invited guests to the Texas headquarters of Unocal to negotiate their support for the pipeline. Subsequent reports will indicate that the negotiations failed, allegedly because the Taliban wanted too much money. Source, the British Broadcasting Company, December 4th, 1997. 1998, the CIA ignores warnings from case officer Robert Baer that Saudi Arabia was harboring an al-Qaeda cell led by two terrorists. A more detailed list of known terrorists is offered to Saudi intelligence in August 2001 and is refused. Financial Times of London, 112-01, in the book See No Evil. 1998 and 2000, former President George Herbert Walker Bush travels to Saudi Arabia on behalf of the privately owned Carlyle Group, the 11th largest defense contractor in the United States. While there, he meets privately with the Saudi royal family and with the Bin Laden family. Personally meets with them. They're major investors in the Carlyle Group, privately owned. Yet it buys all kinds of defense contractors, including some that make vaccines. The source, by the way, is the Wall Street Journal story of September 27, 2001. January 2001, the Bush administration orders the FBI and intelligence agencies to back off investigations involving the Bin Laden family, including two of Osama's cousins, Abdullah and Omar, who are living in Falls Church, Virginia. Falls Church, Virginia is right next to the CIA's headquarters in Langley. We have a direct order to back off investigations of these two relatives who are known connected to a terrorist group, WAMI, the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, and a journalist by the name of Greg Palast, American journalist writing for BBC. Not only does he break the story, he produces an FBI 199 National Security Report, which he shows on television from the complaints of the FBI agents saying the Bush administration told us to leave these guys alone. They're terrorists. February 13th, UPI terrorism correspondent Richard Sale reports on an ongoing criminal case in U.S. District Court in Manhattan. It's against followers of Osama bin Laden. And what he reveals, what he writes is that in the case, the National Security Agency presents evidence that they had broken all of Osama bin Laden's encrypted communications. They were reading all of his codes. They knew every phone conversation. Now, May 2001, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, a drug smuggler all of his adult life from Southeast Asia to Iran-Contra, was convicted, was denied appointments to Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan. He is our Deputy Secretary of State right now. Colin Powell called him in the Washington Times in 1995, my white son. Armitage goes to India in May 2001, and while the CIA director, George Tenet, makes a quiet visit to Pakistan to meet with General Pervez Musharraf, our wonderful ally. They say that there is a very long meeting between Tenet and Musharraf. Okay, so it's reasonable to assume, don't you think, that if the CIA director goes to Pakistan, meets with the head of state, that the head of Pakistani intelligence would be there. Very long meeting. Just remember that. June 2001, German intelligence, the BND, Bundesnachrichtendienst, warns the CIA and Israel that Middle Eastern terrorists are planning to hijack commercial aircraft to use as weapons to attack important symbols of American and Israeli culture. Source, Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, September 14, 2001. This is not some random notice. This is one of the best intelligence agencies in the world, the BND, telling the CIA that the terrorists are going to hijack commercial aircraft for suicide missions to attack America. Just that's one piece. July 2001, three American officials, Tom Simmons, Carl Inderfirth, Lee Coldren, all former State Department bigwigs, meet with Pakistani and Russian intelligence officers in Berlin and tell them that the U.S. is planning military strikes against Afghanistan in October. The Taliban is there. We are announcing to the Taliban, we're going to bomb you to pieces in October. And it happens in July. And this is a French book, La Vérité Interdite. But this is reported in The Guardian, great paper in Britain, the BBC, September 18th, and the Interpress Service, November 16th. Very well confirmed. These meetings took place. Can we call that provocation? Yes. Summer 2001, according to September 26th story in Britain's The Guardian, correspondent David Lee reports that the Department of Defense official Jeffrey Starr visited Tajikistan in January. The Guardian's Felicity Lawrence established that U.S. Rangers were training special troops in Kyrgyzstan. We've been preparing for the war for a long time. Pakistani ISI chief General Mahmoud Ahmad orders $100,000 wired by an aide directly to Mohammed Atta, the lead hijacker, who was, according to the FBI, the lead terrorist. Ahmad resigned after the transfer was disclosed in India and, get this, confirmed by the FBI. The head of Pakistani intelligence sent $100,000 to the lead hijacker. The Times of India, October 11th, 2001, is where I got the story. No one has challenged, not even the CIA has denied that story. Summer 2001, an Iranian man phones U.S. law enforcement to warn of an imminent attack on the World Trade Center in the week of September the 9th. Now go back. You have the BND saying hijacked airplanes attacking important symbols of American and Israeli cultures. We now know it's the World Trade Center in the week of September 9th. German police confirmed the calls because they were monitoring the calls, but state that the U.S. Secret Service, that means the CIA, that was a translation, would not reveal any further information. Source, the German news agency online, DE. I got a translation from it from the website online, IE, which is in Ireland. June 26, 2001, the magazine IndiaReacts.com states that India and Iran will facilitate U.S. and Russian plans for limited military action against the Taliban. The story indicates that the fighting will be done by U.S. and Russian troops with the help of Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. Source, India Reacts magazine, June 26, 2001. August 2001, the FBI arrests an Islamic militant linked to bin Laden in Boston. French intelligence sources confirm that the man is a key member of bin Laden's network, and the FBI learns that he has been taking flying lessons. At the time of his arrest, the man is in possession of technical information on Boeing aircraft and flight manuals. Now we know suicide airplanes hijacked, crashed into the World Trade Center the week of September 9th, and we have terrorists located in Boston. Source, Reuters, September 13th. August 11th or 12th. U.S. Navy Lieutenant Delmart Mike Vreeland, who has been in jail in a Toronto jail cell since December of 2000, writes a handwritten warning because he's been screaming to his jailers for a long time, bin Laden's going to attack, there's going to be major terrorist attacks, they didn't listen. On August 11th or 12th, he writes a note, gives it to his jailers and says, seal it away where I can't touch it, I told you this was going to happen. And it was sealed away. I know because I've been to the courtroom in Toronto. I've met with his lawyers. I have a copy of it. In this note, Navy Lieutenant Delmert Mike Vreeland writes, and notice what he says here. This says, Navy Pier, Sears Tower, World Trade Center, White House, Pentagon, World Bank, Water Supplies, Parliament Building in Ottawa, the Royal Bank, Toronto. Then it says right down here, let one happen, stop the rest. Let one happen, stop the rest. That implies absolute complete intelligence penetration of all of the terrorist operations. It says right here, bin Laden. This note was sealed. The Canadian government admits under oath in court that Vreeland wrote the letter on August 11th or 12th. They don't know because they didn't date it at the time, but that he had no access to it, no custody of it. It was sealed in jail property, that he couldn't touch it. They opened it on September the 14th. That fact is not disputed. Now, what the Navy is saying is that Delmert Mike Vreeland was discharged as a seaman recruit after 4 months in the Navy in 1986. Unsatisfactory performance. So his lawyers subpoenaed his service record. They got back 1,200 pages. How long does it take you to accumulate a 1,200-page service record? The dates have been cut out. There's white out. There's liquid. They were so rushed they couldn't figure it out. And yet they insist that the guy was discharged from the Navy. And a funny thing happened on January 10th of this year. His lawyers, Rocco Galati and Paul Slansky, in one of the boldest moves I've ever seen, January 10th, the Navy's swearing under oath this guy was a seaman recruit. So they got on a speakerphone in court with the court reporter and speakerphone, dialed 411, said, I'd like the number for the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. They got it on the speakerphone. The court reporter's typing away. They get the Pentagon operator on the phone. I say, we're trying to locate a naval officer, Lieutenant Delmert Vreeland. We don't have his number. Hold on a minute. Oh, I've got him. Lieutenant Vreeland, office number such and such, and here's his phone number. The reason why is they'd taken down the computerized control system after the crash. And they'd reverted to the old system from which he had not been purged. Open court! So, Vreeland's story is, my God, well, you know, I was going to Russia, and he's still trying to avoid revealing top secret information by saying I was sent to gather information on Star Wars and some BS, which he's doing so that he doesn't get instantly killed, because the U.S. is trying to extradite him here, and he knows that he's going to be murdered the moment he gets back in U.S. soil. He's fighting to stay in Canada as a refugee. By the way, here's a story from the Toronto Star on that, which covered it briefly. That just confirms what I told you as far as the opening of the letter. Vreeland came across information he wasn't supposed to get while he was in Moscow. When you have intelligence operatives running around, he had a per diem of 19,000 a day. That was his Pentagon per diem. In other words, these guys handle lots of money. And the Pentagon, or all intelligence agencies, always build in credit card fraud mechanisms so that if the guy ever crosses a line, they can get him arrested anytime they ever want to. That's how they control them. So he was arrested on credit card fraud charges for his own credit card. And that's why the government's trying to extradite him back to the States, because he had come across the evidence of September the 11th. Summer 2001, Russian intelligence notifies the CIA that 25 terrorist pilots have been specifically training for suicide missions. This is reported by the Russian press and translated for me by one of my sources, who was a former CIA case officer. Now, I kind of played stinky with this. I wanted to see who would challenge me on this, and I got some feelers from a Russian journalist, and he says, "We cannot find this anywhere in the Russian press." You know, so I knew that I had the backup. It was from Izvestia, and I sent him the article. And it clearly says 25 suicide pilots training, Russian intelligence was telling us. I mean, these weren't. If we knew this, if the world press knew this, what did our intelligence services with a $30 billion budget know? I mean, all of us could have figured out what was going on at the World Trade Center. Let's continue. August 2001, Vladimir Putin orders Russian intelligence to warn U.S. government in the strongest possible terms of imminent attacks on airports and government buildings. I saw it, MSNBC, September 15th. September 3rd through 10th, MSNBC reports on September 16th that a caller to the Cayman Islands talk show gave several warnings of an imminent attack on the U.S. by bin Laden. Now, get this one, September 1 through 10th. In an exercise called Operation Swift Sword, planned for 4 years, 23,000 British troops are already steaming toward Oman before the first plane ever hits the World Trade Center. There was a slight hiccup in the deployment, but it was a 4-year plan. All you military vets know that you don't make those kind of deployments after a month. The military don't move that fast. They'd planned for 4 years. It was the largest British armada to set sail since the Falkland Islands War. Oman, by the way, is right next to Pakistan, to Iran, to Saudi Arabia. It's central to all operations in the region. At the same time, two U.S. aircraft carrier battle groups are rendezvousing, they're rotating what they call it, right off the Pakistani coast. That's not a normal deployment. It just happened to be there. Aw, shucks. But at the same time also, 17,000 U.S. troops join more than 23,000 NATO troops in Egypt for Operation Bright Star. All of these forces are in place before the first plane hits the World Trade Center. Sources, The Guardian, CNN, Fox, The Observer, an international law professor, a very brave guy, Francis Boyle at the University of Illinois, was outraged. September 7th, 2001, Florida Governor Jeb Bush signs a 2-year emergency executive order number 01261, making new provisions for the Florida National Guard to assist law enforcement and emergency management personnel. Two words he adds to the new executive order on September 7th, or acts of terrorism. That's 4 days before the attacks. September 6th and 7th, 2001. Now, if I didn't have you yet, and if you weren't mad, you're going to be. 4,744 put options, bet that stock prices will fall dramatically, are purchased on United Airlines as opposed to only 396 call options. That's a bet the stock will go up. Highly abnormal. That trade level is about 600 to 700% above normal. Let's bear in mind also that some 5,000, 4,000 to 5,000 put options were placed on American Airlines on September the 10th, 1 day before the attack. No other airlines had any other similar trading patterns. Reuters issued a story, September 10th, airline stocks poised for takeoff. The 4,744 put options on United Airlines were purchased through the investment bank A.B. Brown, Alex Brown, Deutsche Bank, that was headed until 1998 by the man who is currently the executive director of the Central Intelligence Agency. And I have written in a number of previous articles that the CIA, the Mossad, British intelligence, using very sophisticated software called Promise, P-R-O-M-I-S, monitor all stock trading in real time. September 10th, 4,516 put options are purchased on American Airlines as compared to 748 call options. September 6th through 11th, no other airlines show any similar trading patterns to those experienced by UAL and American. The put option purchases on both airlines were 600% above normal. Highly abnormal levels of put options are purchased on major reinsurance companies. AXA Reinsurance, Munich Re. Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley were also hit heavily in the World Trade Center attacks. My source for this was this report, dated September 23rd, 12 days after the attacks, from the Herzliya Institute, International Policy Institute for Counterterrorism in Herzliya, Israel. It's the Mossad. It's the Mossad. And I read that they had found out that the trades were made through Alex Brown, and I said, holy smokes, they know that the U.S. government committed these attacks or, you know, set them up and allowed them to happen. They're leaking that information. But this was backed up. Clearly somebody knew the attacks were going to take place. Now, one of the questions I'm asked most often is, well, Mike, you got to tell us who made the trades. And the answer is, I can't. Trades of brokers are as protected as medical records. I can't go find out who bought them and who sold them. Banking secrecy laws. The only people who can find out are the FBI, the SEC, the Department of Justice, and Congress. And they haven't lifted a finger to find out who made those trades. Do you think they have something to hide? Could be. Let's go on with the timeline. Come down to September 11th. General Mahmoud Ahmad of the ISI, that's the guy who wired the money to Mohammed Atta, is actually in Washington, D.C. on the day of September the 11th. He's not at the Pentagon. He happens to be meeting off campus with a bunch of military officers, probably to discuss war plans. September the 11th, the day of the attacks, employees of Odigo Inc. in Israel, one of the world's largest instant messaging companies with offices in New York, receives threat warnings of an imminent attack on the World Trade Center less than 2 hours before the first plane hits. Guess where the Odigo offices are? They're in the city of Herzliya, Israel. They immediately notify the Mossad, who immediately sends the warning bells to CIA and the Pentagon. 2 hours before the attacks. Sources for that, CNN's Daniel Seberg, 92801, News Bites, Brian McWilliams, 92701, and Haaretz, the Israeli paper, 92601. September 11th, from 8:15 a.m. until 9:05 a.m., with it widely known within the FAA and the U.S. military that four airliners have been simultaneously hijacked, an event which has never before occurred in world or American history. Not a single Air Force plane is scrambled. Now, there is a fabulous researcher named Jared Israel, whose website is www.tenc.net, the Emperor's New Clothes, who pulled the FAA manuals, who pulled the U.S. Air Force manuals. And what he found out is something very clear. For more than 25 years, it has been standard FAA and U.S. Air Force policy the moment any airplane under FAA control goes off course, deviates from flight plan, loses transponder control, your pilots know that you got to push a little button that identifies you on the radar screen, or loses radio contact, that fighter aircraft must be scrambled to intercept. Not shoot it down, just go fly up alongside of it and see what's going on. Standard FAA procedure that has been followed in every case since 1974, 75, 76. And yet some 70 minutes after the first plane hits the World Trade Center, you have Vice President Cheney on television telling you, we just didn't know what to do, and the president wasn't there to scramble the airplanes. The only way that fighters could not have been scrambled on September 11th was if the National Command Authority, the President, the Vice President, Secretary of Defense, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, had ordered the fighters to stand down. And you believe that they got away with this? What's worse is Jared has gone to the Andrews Air Force Base website, which has been changed since September the 11th. I used to work outside of Andrews Air Force Base. I saw F-16s, F-15s. I'm an Air Force brat. F-18s taken off all the time. You read the site now and it says, well, we maintain Air National Guard and Reserve squadrons, implying that there were no pilots on the base. Yet pre-September 11th, the website said, we maintain Air National Guard Reserve combat squadrons in the highest state of readiness. They call it ready response. What's ready response mean? You got your pilots in jumpsuits, they're gassed, you go hop in the plane and you take off. Air Force pilots regularly rotate on TDY, temporary duty, through these pilots. Andrews Air Force Base is the home of Air Force One. You think they wouldn't have fighters there? The whole website's been taken down. Jared preserved the original writings versus the post writings. evidence of a conspiracy and a cover-up. They were flat lying. Now, let's go a little further. Okay, by the way, the sources for some of the scrambling on the Times, they waited 75 minutes. The sources were CNN, ABC, MSNBC, the LA Times, the New York Times. You just read their timelines. September 15th, the New York Times reports that Mayo Shattuck III has resigned effective immediately as the head of Alex Brown Deutsche Bank. The guy that handled the insider trades resigns the day after the attacks. He only had a $30 million contract. And I've since found out that he's very tight with John Poindexter. He's a classic insider. But he resigns. I've called the SEC about 10 times, or my writers have. And all they say is, we will neither confirm nor deny the existence of any investigation into insider trading around September the 11th. You call Congress and they say, we don't know anything about it. We're not going to hold hearings. October 10th, the Pakistani newspaper The Frontier Post reports that Ambassador Wendy Chamberlain has paid a call on the Pakistani oil minister. A previously abandoned Unocal pipeline from Turkmenistan across Afghanistan to the Pakistani coast for the purpose of selling oil and gas to China is now back on the table in view of recent geopolitical developments. They didn't wait long, did they? November 2001, the British newspaper The Independent runs a story headlined, Opium Farmers Rejoice at Taliban Defeat. November 25th, the Observer runs a story headline, Victorious Warlords Set to Open Opium Floodgates. December 4th, convicted drug lord opium kingpin Ayub Afridi is recruited by the U.S. government. The guy's doing 7 years for heroin dealing. Now he's a U.S. government consultant. A Pakistani general, by the way, has quit and gone on Australian TV and said, listen, it's all about opium. What's wrong with you guys? Don't you idiots get it? You know, they're fighting over opium and oil. Pakistani general confirms publicly that war on terrorism is all about heroin. SBS television on 14 January in Australia. And on February 9th, not too long ago, Pakistani leader General Musharraf and Afghan leader Hamid Karzai announced their agreement to cooperate in all spheres of the pipeline construction across Afghanistan, and Pakistan even gives $10 million cash to Afghanistan to keep their administrators who are supervising the pipeline construction in place. Do you think anybody had foreknowledge? Now, let's take a look at the Patriot Act. This act is an abomination. We have lost one-third of the Bill of Rights, and you don't even know it. And let me tell you exactly how we lost them. The FBI now has the right to enter your home when you're not there without a search warrant, to seize evidence, and to use it in court against you. The Fourth Amendment prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures. The FBI and the CIA can now automatically wiretap all of your emails, no warrant necessary. All of your telephone conversations, no warrant necessary. As a matter of fact, in the ultimate FU that I have heard since Iran-Contra, John Poindexter, who was Oliver North's boss during Iran-Contra, was made director of the Office of Information Awareness and given a $2 billion budget to monitor all emails in the United States for anything of interest to the president. The Fourth Amendment's gone. Now, John Ashcroft said, I'm going to wiretap attorney-client conversations. Only in terrorist cases, I swear. Only when the people have brown skin. He did that by fiat. It wasn't even an act of Congress. And Senator Pat Leahy wrote him 6 letters and said, Attorney General Ashcroft, I want you before this committee, the Judiciary Committee. He finally demanded a written response. He got one. It was an anthrax letter. President Bush announced military tribunals wherein those accused can be executed in a secret trial with no public exposure, even if one-third of the officers disagree, that the evidence against the accused does not have to be presented, and that he has no right to confront his accusers. The Sixth Amendment to the United States Constitution provides every person in this country the right to see the evidence against them and to confront their accusers in a public trial. There goes the Sixth Amendment, 4, 5, and 6. And the Patriot Act also says that if the FBI comes to your office in a terrorist investigation and seizes all of your business records, that you cannot tell anybody that the FBI has been there, or you will go to jail. There goes your freedom of speech, part of the First Amendment. Self-incrimination was the fifth. That's gone in the wiretapping. Protected conversations, husband, wife, lawyer, client, priest, rabbi, minister, with confessor, gone. Just gone. Now, everybody here knows that the FBI and the CIA have been wiretapping people all over the country for decades. And we go, well, gee, why is that new? You missed the point. All of the information the FBI and the CIA has gathered by illegally wiretapping for 30, 40, 50 years, going back to COINTELPRO, going back to anti-war, going back to civil rights, Martin Luther King, all of it could never have been admitted into a court of law because it was gathered illegally. Under the Patriot Act, all of the information that FBI and CIA have gathered illegally can now be turned over to the Los Angeles Police Department, the Chicago Police Department, the San Francisco Police Department, who may then use it as probable cause information to get an investigation of you. And when they find one other piece of evidence, all the probable cause information goes onto the record. The exclusionary rule is gone. So you say, all right, we have a Supreme Court. I don't even have to go there, do I? They broke the law to give George W. Bush the election. They're already corrupted. So what does that mean? We are living in an empire. Treat it like an empire. Don't delude yourself. Stop writing letters to your congresspeople. Some of you are going to go rattle Nancy Pelosi's cage. Oh, she deserves it. But don't go to her by any means expecting any member of Congress to be able to help you. I was in Washington for 5 days in December. They weren't even getting their mail while I was there. They couldn't get their own mail. There are some members of Congress at the committee chair levels, the whip levels, and Pelosi's a whip, who exercise some real power, but she's also the ranking member now of the House Intelligence Committee, which is chaired by a former CIA officer, Porter Goss. Don't try to go to a member of Congress and say, change the government. You can embarrass them. That's good. You can out them. You get them into a public venue and you confront them with what they're doing in public. But don't go expect them to do for you what you should have been doing for yourself for the last 50 years. Now, for all the FBI agents in the audience, I will tell you something, and I will tell you something fearlessly, and I'm not ashamed to say it. According to James Madison, Monroe, Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr, Patrick Henry, Ben Franklin, all of the founding fathers, a revolution is my divine right. And I will not apologize for it, and I will not be ashamed to say it. Because I know the truth, that the legacy, what gave modern era politics, which we've all been brainwashed to forget, was the fundamental understanding that God wove freedom into every fiber of creation. You cannot take it away. The most offensive statement I have heard since September the 11th was Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge, when he stood up at his confirmation public press conference and he said, civil liberties are one of the most precious gifts that we give to our citizens. I got news for you, Governor Ridge. You don't give me nothing. You don't give us nothing. We give it to you then sparingly, and we have the right to take it back whenever we choose to, if we choose to, and if we have the will. Period. Let me read you a little quote here out of order before I wrap this up. Abraham Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus in 1866 during the Civil War, and he put some protesters and resistors in prison. The Supreme Court, when we had a Supreme Court, said the Constitution of the United States is a law for rulers and people equally in war and in peace, and covers with the shield of its protection all classes of men at all times and under all circumstances. No doctrine involving more pernicious consequences was ever invented by the wit of man than that any of its provisions can be suspended during any of the great exigencies of government. That is what a court is supposed to tell us about this Constitution. Period. The congressional investigation of September 11th will be a total whitewash. It's been placed under the control of Britt Snyder, the former CIA Inspector General, who covered up Volume 2 of all of the CIA's drug dealing in Iran-Contra after the Gary Webb stories came out. He is a class operative. He's very familiar with me because I was a part of that investigation. I was not allowed to testify. Gary wasn't allowed to testify. And Volume 2 of the CIA's Inspector General report, I publish excerpts from that. These are edited by me. You read this, and it says clearly that the CIA dealt with 56 known traffickers, kept 8 out of jail, briefed Vice President Bush on how they were lying to Congress. There's telling CIA documents showing that one guy with his weekly shipment of 220 kilos of cocaine, a telegram came from CIA headquarters, do not debrief the man, let him go. CIA's own records. That's what Britt Snyder overlooked as Inspector General of the CIA. He will do the same thing in the congressional hearings on September the 11th. Hold no faith in those hearings. Before I wrap up, the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act is a pending bill which Health and Human Services has now introduced successfully into 24 state legislatures. It has been passed already in the state of Kentucky, and it's being enacted as a state law the same way they enforced the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. The Health and Human Services is saying we're going to withdraw our federal funding for Medi-Cal and Medicare if you don't pass this law. This law makes it a felony to refuse a vaccination when ordered by a state government. This law makes it a felony to refuse any medical treatment ordered by a state or local government. This law allows state and local officials in cases of declared medical emergencies to seize any private property without recourse, compensation, or any hearing, condemn it, or appropriate any private property for use during any medical emergency. No trial, no nothing. This allows any state or local agency to quarantine, seal off any neighborhood, evict anybody from their home, stop all water transportation, put people in any kind of lockup they choose to. It's already been passed in Kentucky. Let's look at what's going on here. Since October the 4th, the largest outbreak of an Ebola-like virus took place on the Afghani-Pakistani border. 75 people. Wonderful quote in here. The doctor says, you watch the patients melt in front of your eyes. This was dated 7 October, just after the attacks. The British are digging up 10 victims of the deadliest disease ever to hit the planet, the Spanish flu, to get the DNA, just in case it ever outbreaks again. Get this. The U.S. government has requested 300 million smallpox doses. The contract's been let. A company called Acambus is fulfilling the contract right now. How many people have had a smallpox vaccination? Weren't we all told that it was good for life? But how scared do you need to be? You remember what you heard tonight and that you're responsible for doing something with it.
You have been listening to Michael C. Rupert, editor and publisher of From the Wilderness, on the truth and lies of 9/11. You have heard excerpts of a lecture he gave at San Francisco's Fort Mason on February 21st, 2002. The website of From the Wilderness is www.copvcia.com. That's www.copvcia.com. On that site, you can order a 138-minute video of a similar lecture Mike Rupert gave in Portland, Oregon, in November of 2001. The video presents visual evidence of many of the documents he referred to in this program.
Guns and Butter, The Economics of Politics, has a page on the website of RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange. The address is www.riseforNews.net. That's RISE, the numeral 4, news.net. Our email address is gnb@risefornews.net. Thanks for listening.